Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama and Asia-Pacific leaders meeting in Lima, Peru, are still focusing Sunday on trade and the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump. The U.S. president and other world leaders are in Lima for the annual Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting, the APEC summit. And barring unforeseen circumstances, this will be the final foreign trip of Obama's 8 years in the White House. On Saturday, Obama had a message for 1,000 young leaders from all over Latin America and the Caribbean on President-elect Trump, saying don't assume the worst.
Democracy means that sometimes you have to compromise. And it means that, you know, the outcomes of elections don't always turn out the way you would hope. And then you know, we're going through that in the United States, and I'm doing everything I can to help facilitate a successful transition with the president-elect in the United States.
Meanwhile, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump is continuing to meet with prospective candidates for high-level jobs within his administration. Vice President-elect Mike Pence, who is in charge of the transition team, spoke on CBS's Face the Nation about Saturday's meeting with Republican Mitt Romney.
I would tell you that it was not only a cordial meeting, but also it was a very substantive meeting. And I can say that Governor Romney is under active and serious consideration to serve as Secretary of State of the United States.
Romney had opposed Trump's candidacy during the campaign, and this Sunday Trump sat down with Wilbur Ross, a potential Commerce Secretary, and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. This is VOA News. The top U.S. military and intelligence chiefs want President Obama to fire the National Security Chief. That's according to the Washington Post, the first to report that Defense Secretary Ash Carter and Director of National Intelligence James Clapper made the recommendation last month to the White House to remove Admiral Michael Rogers, who is the head of both the National Security Agency and U.S. Military Cyber Command. The reason for Carter and Clapper's push for dismissal was not immediately clear. President-elect Donald Trump is considering Rogers for an intelligence spot within his administration. At least 96 people have been killed and 100 others injured during a train derailment in northern India. Rescue workers and volunteers have been combing through the badly mangled coaches to see if they can locate additional survivors of the derailment that happened early Sunday morning. Dozens of ambulances were deployed to the site. It's not clear why 14 of the train's coaches were thrown off the tracks. French conservatives are voting this Sunday in a nationwide primary to choose their nominee for next year's presidential election. That's following a campaign marked by concerns about the influx of migrants into Europe and the devastating series of jihadist attacks in France. Seven candidates are competing in the first round of the primary. Results, or at least a runoff, is scheduled for November 27th. On the minds of many is what's happening in the United States as well, with some protesters saying they are concerned about statements made by President-elect Trump during the campaign.
We're not contesting election results, but in every democracy, I believe there's a government and there's an opposition in a healthy democracy, and we are that opposition. The things he has said are not okay. He has targeted everyone, women, Muslims, Mexicans, immigrants. Everything that makes America great, he has targeted. And we are here to say that is not okay.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has announced that she will seek a fourth term as head of government after meeting with other leaders of her Christian Democrats in Berlin Sunday. The 62-year-old has been widely considered a stabilizing force in Europe at a time of uncertainty after Britain's referendum to leave the European Union and the election of Donald Trump as the next U.S. president. White House National Security Advisor Susan Rice warned the Syrian regime and its Russian backers Saturday that they will be held accountable for the heinous bombings of hospitals and rebel-held portions of Aleppo. Rice said the Syrian regime and its allies, Russia in particular, bears the responsibility of the immediate and long-term consequences these actions have caused in Syria and beyond. Airstrikes and artillery fire carried out by government forces there killed at least 27 people Saturday. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We are fighting to have this problem in our parliament so that we can allow people to have two nationalities. But for the time being, it's forbidden for our constitution.
Opposition parties in the Democratic Republic of Congo demand the immediate resignation of the newly appointed prime minister.
The president must show real measures to say that, yes, we are committed as a government to cut all this spending that we have for members of parliament, for instance. So if they can cut all their personal emoluments, then we're going to show a real commitment. Otherwise, the opposition will continue saying that this is merely publicity stunt for the president and this party.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu cuts away 50% of his salary.
There is a difference between UN Protection Force and UN taking over the South for 10 to 15 years. I am against, and I believe everybody in South Sudan is against UN colonizing the South, taking over the executive functions, the legislative, disarming the SPLA for 10 to 15 years.
And a UN report accuses a South Sudanese diplomat of agitating against the presence of the United Nations mission in the country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The police in the Democratic Republic of Congo prevented opposition supporters from meeting on Saturday. The opposition groups say this is yet another attempt by President Kabila's government to undermine the constitution. Meanwhile, the opposition groups also demand the new prime minister should resign or be fired for being a non-Congolese citizen. For more, I reach Alberta Fabrice Puella, an opposition parliamentarian.
We condemn this attitude because we are a democratic country. Can you imagine that people without guns, without anything bad, they want only to go to hear the opposition leaders, but they prevent people to go to that. That meaning only one thing, they want Mr. Kabila to maintain in power, to maintain in the office. We know that just in 30 days, he has to go. Exactly in December the 19th, he has to leave the power. And doing that is really the opposition of democracy, and we can't accept that. That's why we are asking our people to stand and to fight for our rights, as Bob Marley has seen it.
The opposition is also saying that the new prime minister is not a Congolese citizen. Why is this so?
You know, all people have his own secret. Mr. Sami Badibanga is a member of parliament, as I am. But he never said before that he has a Belgian citizenship. And only yesterday we saw a document saying that since 2002, he obtained Belgian nationality. Our constitution forbids someone to have two nationalities. That's why if Mr. Kabila is consequence, he has to dismiss him. Or you can lead the country with two nationalities or having a foreign nationality. We are fighting to have this problem in our parliament so that we can allow people to have two nationalities. But for the time being, it's forbidden for our constitution. So Mr. Sami Badibanga can't be the prime minister of our country, even if just for 1 month.
But the issue is that he was a member of parliament. Why didn't this come out till now that he was named as a prime minister?
For sure he had this information. Nobody knew that before. But, you know, our constitution and our electoral law say that only Congolese people can be elected as a member of parliament, can be a president of the country, prime minister or minister. So, for sure, He didn't say to anybody that he was a foreigner, that he has another nationality. If we knew that, for sure, he couldn't be elected as a member of parliament.
So now that he is the prime minister selected by the president to form a government and lead the transition, what is the opposition going to do about this?
According to us, the appointment of the prime minister is not really, we are not really concerned about it. We are concerned by the departure of Mr. Kabila for this end of his mandate. He has to leave the office in the next month, in 2016. About government, we are really concerned about it. He can be there for one day, 2 days. Okay, he can be there, but according to us, Mr. Kabila can no more lead our country. Yes. To leave the country, we have to choose someone who can lead the country during this limited transition before the election.
Albert Fabrice Puela is an opposition Congolese parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the port city of Matadi. Zambian President Edgar Lungu has asked for his salary to be cut by half as part of the government's soon-to-be-implemented austerity measures. Vice President Inonga Wina informed Parliament that President Lungu will reduce his monthly pay due to the country's poor economic outlook. For reaction, I reached Richard Mulunga, an independent multimedia journalist in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Yes, the president has announced that he's going to take a 50% cut from his salary to show the Zambian people leadership that he is ready to be with the people and prepare them for this difficult future that we have. There have been mixed reactions to that, you know, depending on how people have received the news. For example, some civil society organizations have said that the president can do much more, you know, to show austerity than just cutting his salary. Some other sectors in society here have accepted and welcome the president's move, saying that, yes, we need to elect the president and be preparing ourselves for the difficult journey ahead.
Is this only for the president? What about his vice and cabinet ministers?
And that is the question that some critics are asking, that if the president really meant well with his austerity measures, the real austerity does not lie in him cutting his salary because he has all these international trips and other privileges. So they are saying that the real austerity that the president can show to Zambian people is by cutting his bloated government and by also cutting his international travels, you know, to meetings and other engagements where he can be represented by the Minister of Foreign Affairs or the embassies abroad. So some people are saying that just cutting the salary really does not translate into real savings for the country. But if he can cut his cabinet, and, you know, that is coming also with a backdrop that their proposed constitutional amendments here where they want to reintroduce the position of cabinet ministers. So when that happens, the cabinet is going to go to somewhere around 70, and where is all that money going to come from? So these are the things that they think the president must address in order for him to show real austerity.
I understand some UPND and other opposition party groups are saying that this is a mere publicity stunt, and that if he really wants to have cost-cutting measures or tightening of belt, it has to go across board.
Yes, there have been discussions like that, especially from the opposition, that the president must show real measures to say that, yes, we are committed as a government to cut all this spending that we have for members of parliament, for instance, from his ministers and the, all these other big people in the civil service. So if they can cut all their personal emoluments, then we're going to show real commitment. Otherwise, the opposition will continue saying that this is merely publicity stunt for the president and this party.
Others are saying that it's only possibly public sector workers who would feel the pinch rather than the private sector. How are people talking about the effect this would have on the economy?
Well, you cannot separate the people in the private sector and those in the public sector. We are all under the same blanket. When the economy is not doing fine, everyone suffers. So this difficult journey that we have, it has across the board. Everyone is preparing for austerity. Everyone is going to be affected by it. So we have to, you know, amalgamate our efforts from our different backgrounds in the private sector and in the public sector so that we can find a real solution and something tangible that will cushion us from the rough economic terrain that we are experiencing.
Well, the UPND and other opposition groups are saying that the Patriotic Front Party, the present government, is to blame for the country's poor economic outlook, and that measures have not been made to really strengthen the economy or jumpstart the economy. What is the government saying in defense of its policies?
The government has always been defending its policies that they are pro-poor, that they want to bring development for the Zambian people. For instance, they have been spending a lot of money in building infrastructure such as roads and hospitals. And that is why most of the resources for the country are growing, and this is why we have this problem as a country. The government is saying that we have to develop infrastructure so that we can attract investment and all these other incentives so that we can, grow the economy. But even if, we have all these poverty reduction programs, we still have people that are living below the poverty bottom line. We have all these efforts that we are focused at growing the economy. We want the economy to grow at 6%. And according to the papers, we are doing fine. But when you go to the people, you find that actually economic growth and the translating does not necessarily translate into poverty reduction. So the government must shift from policies that are looking at growing the economy, but into programs that are looking at reducing the real poverty on the ground.
Richard Mulonga is a Zambian independent multimedia journalist. He spoke with me from Lusaka. A Zimbabwean human rights lawyers group is challenging a presidential decree to issue bond notes. They would be an alternative to the dollars and rands which have been used for several years by consumers in local transactions. Government officials say the notes will replace dollars which are in short supply, but opponents fear the move would lead to hyperinflation. Zimbabwe Chimga is senior programs manager for Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights. My colleague William Eagle asked him why his group is trying to stop the new currency.
The main reason that has prompted us to approach the High Court is we take issue with the procedural aspect of the legislation that was used to promulgate the issuance of the bond notes. In particular, we think that the president, in amending the Reserve Bank Act to allow for the promulgation of an instrument that issues the bond notes, is actually usurping the power that should be vested in Parliament. So in other words, he has no authority to use the Presidential Powers Act to amend a law that has been passed by Parliament. So it's really an issue of separation of powers between the executive and Parliament.
Does the President not have the ability to introduce bond notes or other measures in cases of emergency?
This situation of the bond note is not an emergent issue that has arisen a day or a week or even a month ago. It's an issue at a policy level that has been considered in the past 6 months. So if the intention was to pass a law via the RDZ Act or another law for that matter that would enable the issuance of bond notes, it should have ordinarily gone through the Parliament.
Would you, as a group of lawyers concerned with human rights, would you be against the bond notes if the Parliament had drafted the legislation rather than have President Mugabe issue it as a decree?
The advantage of this issue having been taken through Parliament, and this is why we strongly oppose the use of the presidential powers, is that would, as you know, in terms of parliamentary democracy and constitutional democracy, would have had the opportunity for public debate before the adoption of any law. That would have enabled us as human rights lawyers and the public indeed to interrogate the legality, the framework, the structure itself of these bond notes, and would have been able to evaluate whether this is in the interest of government or in the interest of the people, so to speak.
Do you have confidence in the ability of the High Court to hear your case in a neutral, unbiased way?
What I would say is that the court itself is not homogeneous. We see liberal judges, we see conservative judges, we see progressive judges, and you would report that one of the judges of the High Court, in fact, ruled in our favor and pronounced that there was a right to freedom of petition. And, of course, that judgment was contradicted by another judge. So the view that we take is that depending on who sits on the day, there is reasonable expectation on our side that justice will be given.
Opposition leader Joyce Mujuru and her Zimbabwe People's First Party have also filed a similar court challenge with the Constitutional Court. Is there a difference between a ruling by the High Court and the Constitutional Court?
The Joyce Mujuru matter that you speak about, I'm not involved in that case, but I understand they take a different point where they argue that the bond notes are in effect a form of appropriation because you take an individual's U.S. dollars and seek to replace with a bond note that cannot be transferable, especially out of the country. So because of that, there is an attack on the right to property. So the arguments are a bit different. We are challenging the legal route that has been taken, that is the use of the presidential powers, and they are challenging the constitutionality of the bond note itself. But the effect, if the rulings go our way, would tend to be the same, which is to say that the bond note cannot be issued in Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe Chimga is Senior Programs Manager for the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights. He spoke with my colleague William Eagle from the capital, Harare. Meanwhile, three African countries have signaled to the United Nations Security Council of their plans to formally withdraw their membership from the International Criminal Court, or ICC. Burundi, Gambia, and South Africa say the court appears to target Africans. Russia, which is a veto-wielding member of the Security Council, also said it was withdrawing from the Hague-based court. Dr. Alan White, the former chief of investigations for the United Nations Special Court for Sierra Leone, talks about the withdrawal of support from the ICC in part two of my interview with him. Do you foresee any more countries from Africa withdrawing from the ICC or making efforts to withdraw from the ICC apart from those initial countries, Gambia, South Africa?
Well, I don't know for certain, but certainly there's been talk at the AU for the last 2 years at their annual meetings, and certainly, President Museveni from Uganda was certainly leading one of those efforts. So there are others. Yes, there are others that are talking about it, and it's unfortunate. But right now, the timing to do it is there because there are others already starting to do it. So I do think there will be others that will do it, and probably within the next year, maybe not 2016, but certainly 2017.
Do you think criticisms leveled against Fatou Bensouda about her inability or somewhat refusal to investigate Yahya Jammeh, who is alleged to have committed human rights violations and continue to do so in Gambia, are justified?
Well, you know, certainly that's been a topic of discussion, and there is documented evidence publicly, open source information and otherwise, demonstrating human rights violations there. And certainly these are very serious issues, and I know she's, at least from what I understand, not opened up a case in that area, and it's a very difficult situation for her because she's from the Gambia. Mm-hmm. And I know she wants to be viewed as being fair and making sure that before she pursues those issues, that she certainly has the evidence to justify opening an investigation and pursuing a prosecution. So I think she's cautious, and she's going to get criticism for that. You know, whether or not it's valid at this point in time, we'll remain to be vigilant on that.
Mm. Let's go back to the region and go back to Liberia. Soon there will be elections there.
Correct.
What is your take about the current situation leading up to the election?
Well, certainly one of the things that has never gone away, particularly since our efforts in Sierra Leone, is to seek restorative and retributive justice. The 2008 Truth and Reconciliation Report, it was made very clear that the people of Liberia wanted justice. And whoever the next president is going to be should make sure that the people of Liberia obtain restorative and retributive justice. Now, the dates of jurisdiction in terms of temporal jurisdiction, those are all debatable. But certainly one of the problems that's happening right now is at least the allegations and the source information that I'm receiving is that Charles Taylor, the former president, indicted and convicted war criminal for his actions in Sierra Leone as the leader and creator of the RUF, is now interfering with the elections. And there are allegations that he has been in discussion with Senator George Weah, who has recently signed an agreement to join forces with Jewel Taylor's former wife, mm-hmm. to support seeking the presidency and the vice presidency. George would be at the top of the ticket. And there are allegations, and there's been reported news stories on this, as I'm sure you've seen some of them, and it's documented that he's had discussions with Charles Taylor up in the UK where he's serving his sentence. And part of those discussions is to ensure that there is never a war crimes court, special court for Liberia in Sierra Leone. And there's also other allegations that when he left, there were millions of dollars that were buried and left behind. So whoever gets elected and they seek to get his sentence reduced or commuted and to get him back in Liberia would be worth their while. So there's a lot going on, and there is some interference. And there's only been two people that have been publicly supportive of retributive and restorative justice. And that has been the current vice president, who's running for president, mm-hmm. and then Benanai Yuri. None of the other candidates that I'm aware of have supported restorative or retributive justice.
Let's go to neighboring Sierra Leone. It's understood that President Bayakoroma could try to amend the constitution and stay in power. What are your views about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting for people that aren't on the continent to understand how Africa is. And what I mean by that, you know, our style of democracy in the U.S. may not be a one-size-fits-all for other countries. But certainly trying to amend the Constitution to be in permanent rule does threaten democracy.
Dr. Alan White is the former chief of investigations for the United Nations Special Court for Sierra Leone. He spoke with me from here in the nation's capital. Meanwhile, a diplomat at the South Sudanese Embassy in Washington has been named in a UN report for agitating against the presence of the United Nations in South Sudan. The report cites Ambassador Gordon Boy as consistently using the social media to provoke animosity towards the United Nations. In an interview with John Tanza from the VOA's South Sudan in Focus, the ambassador dismissed the report, calling it biased towards the interest of the United Nations in South Sudan.
I was even surprised why they included my writing in Facebook, because what I wrote, I was only condemning Dr. Luka Byong and Pagana Mum not to call for South Sudan to be ruled by UN for 10 to 15 years. So I didn't. I never wrote anything against the UN protection forces, or that the UN should not be in South Sudan. I didn't write that, because we, as a guy, I'm a representative of the government, and then whatever position the government is taking is what that I defend.
I remember interviewing you, and you told me that you were going to revoke passports of all the people who are calling for UN to take over the country, and you said no UN will step in South Sudan.
No,
this,
I said...
This is on record.
There is a difference between UN protection force and UN taking over the South for 10 to 15 years. So if I am against, and I believe everybody in South Sudan is against UN colonizing the South, taking over the executive function, the legislative, disarming the SPLA for 10 to 15 years. So this is the difference. I'm not against the UN going to South Sudan like what the mandate or what the agreement we signed in 2011 or the UN Protection Force.
Ambassador Boy, your work is as a civil servant, and being a diplomat, you are a civil servant. And I know that your job entitles you to protect the image of your country, to support the policies of your government. But at the same time, your code of conduct, according to the South Sudan Diplomatic Act, it does not allow you to take a partisan position during issues of the country, and your postings have been sounding like you're taking a partisan position. How do you react to that?
It is not a partisan position. If somebody is calling for the colonization of my country, are you saying that I should keep quiet? I cannot keep quiet. I will tell them no. We are a sovereign country. We are an independent country. We are a member of the UN, and we cannot be colonized.
Ambassador Gordon Boy is in charge of diaspora affairs at the South Sudan Embassy. He spoke with John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus from here in Washington. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
I woke up early this morning and I said a little prayer to my God. I said, oh Lord, help me. I need to make some money today. It will be a long, long day. Just like any that I ever heard. Oh, will be a hot, hot day. And the rain might come down on me. Oh, Lord. I just want a little to get me over. Just a tiny, weeny little for me to party. I just want a little to make me feel alive.
To make me feel alive. Love will go. Come on, day. Kala, Wednesday Kau Kanda, Thursday Chips, Friday night, Saturday Fufu, Sunday Love Water.
Good evening, Africa. A dangerous charade is taking place in the Democratic Republic, and we should pay special attention to it. President Joseph Kabila and his close advisors have always wanted to prolong his mandate beyond December, which is the constitutional limit. However, they are fully aware that this is a very difficult aim to achieve in DRC because of the very strong opposition presented by Rassemblement for More, headed by the veteran leader Etienne Tshisekedi. In the circumstances, they conjured up the charade we are now seeing. And the first act of this charade was to seek from the Constitutional Court a ruling that should the Electoral Commission fail to conclude all arrangements for election this year, President Kabila could continue in office. And once that was achieved, Act 2 came in. The Electoral Commission dutifully declared that it could not complete all arrangements until past 2 years. And all of these two acts were condemned by the Rassemblement under Tshisekedi. Then the next act began. The next act was for President Kabila to call for national dialogue in what they call a crisis. Now, the Rassemblement refused to get into any dialogue calling for Kabila to leave as was stated in the Constitution. But there became a rump opposition group, a minority opposition group, which wanted to dialogue with Kabila. Then came the next act. The next act was to seek legitimacy for this dialogue since the Rassemblement was opposed to it. The African Union produced Kodjo. And Mr. Kodjo was strongly opposed by the main opposition, claiming that he was too allied to President Kabila. In any case, the opposition was ignored and the talks continued. The negotiations produced a result which in a sense was quite laughable. It said that under the arrangement, the prime ministership of the country will be given to the rump opposition. Now, we all know that in Africa, most of the presidency are executive presidency, and they are the dominant figure. A prime minister will merely take orders from the president. The opposition, again, strongly opposed to this arrangement. And then Kabila and his advisors then seek further legitimacy. The agreement was presented to countries in Central Africa who then endorsed this arrangement as legitimate. Again, the Rassemblement opposed it. Now, the reason why the Kabila government and his advisors sought this charade is because they knew that in Africa there is strong opposition to the prolongation of office by president contrary to the constitution. They saw the disaster that happened in Burkina Faso, and they saw what is now happening in Burundi. They cannot, of course, follow the model followed in Rwanda, where there is hardly any opposition. So this is where we are. But the signs are very clear that the opposition in the DRC will continue, and regrettably, this might end in bloodshed. The reason why we should pay attention to this charade and to question it is that if it does succeed and President Kabila is able to go beyond the term in the Constitution, it will become a new model for African leaders to use in that always desire to go beyond limits of the Constitution. And this is why all Africans, the international community, must beware of this dangerous charade that is being played out in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Douglas Mpoga, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, in a court of fowls, the cockroach never wins a case. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has partnered with the countries of East Africa to counter violent extremism. On a recent trip to Kenya and Djibouti, U.S. Deputy Coordinator for Counterterrorism Michael Ortiz met with senior government officials, local and county officials, and members of civil society who are working to counter terrorism and violent extremism. Kenya fulfilled its pledge to host a regional Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE, summit in June 2015 and is emerging as a regional leader on this issue. In recent months, the Kenyan government introduced a national Countering Violent Extremism strategy and appointed a senior-level diplomat to lead and coordinate implementation of the strategy's action plan. During this trip, Deputy Coordinator Ortiz discussed with Kenyan officials the importance of partnering with communities and civil society. He also emphasized President Barack Obama's and Secretary John Kerry's message that protecting human rights and building trust in security forces is essential to preventing and countering radicalization. Mr. Ortiz underscored that Kenya can benefit greatly by working closely with civil society, religious leaders, and its international security partners to end violent extremism. Online recruitment and radicalization to violence remain serious challenges, and Mr. Ortiz emphasized that we must do more to educate parents, teachers, and other community leaders on ways to intervene with young people before it is too late. Local communities on the front lines in the fight against violent extremism must be empowered to stop the process of radicalization to violence. That is why the United States has helped establish organizations like the Strong Cities Network and the Global Community Engagement and Resilience Fund, and launched initiatives such as the Global Counterterrorism Forum's Initiative to Address the Life Cycle to Radicalization to Violence. Just this year, the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development started implementing a $7.5 million effort to support the Counterterrorism Partnership Fund in Kenya. In Djibouti, government officials are collaborating with young leaders to address the challenges of violent extremism in partnership with East Africa's Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD. Under IGAD's leadership, the new East Africa CVE Center of Excellence and Counter-Messaging Hub will provide a platform for East Africans to share best practices, collaborate on research on the localized drivers of violent extremism, and develop innovative counter-messaging efforts. The U.S. will continue to assist its partners in East Africa to tackle terrorism and violent extremism and stands ready to lead in this fight.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.